Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Drawing the Iraq War, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Maximilian Uriarte is a graphic artist, and he felt compelled to get to Iraq.
I wanted to see something terrible. My first thought was, what's the quickest way I can get to Iraq and see this war zone for myself? To me, that was the Marine Corps infantry.
Also, as Hillary Clinton takes on Donald Trump, look for her touting some foreign policy know-how.
It's a way of stressing her experience. It's a way of suggesting the risks and dangers associated with the personality of Donald Trump, which polls consistently show it's his biggest vulnerability.
Plus, the Codex Serafinianus.
I would describe it as kind of like an encyclopedia from an alien planet.
Yep, we're all going to bite today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you could be here today. Bernie Sanders does not appear ready to throw in the towel, but after last night's primary wins in New Jersey and California, Hillary Clinton and her supporters are celebrating a historic milestone. First time in our nation's history that a woman is a major party's presumptive nominee for president. Clinton is calling on Democrats to unite, and that means Democrats wherever they might be in the world. So we're reaching out today to one Democrat who happens to be abroad right now. Ian Higham is from Pennsylvania, but he's working on his PhD in Sweden. He's on the line from Örebro in Sweden. So we spoke with you after Super Tuesday back in March, so I know you're a Hillary fan. I guess you're pretty pleased right now, huh?
Yeah, I'm happy with the results. I think it was a really historic night last night, and yeah, I'm content.
What are your feelings about Bernie Sanders staying in the race to the convention?
Well, I like Bernie, but I think it's not the most honorable way to go about his campaign. I think it's showing somewhat poor leadership to not drop out and allow the party to kind of rally around Hillary, but you know, it's his prerogative and it's his right to keep campaigning.
Do you have any friends who are Bernie supporters, either Americans or Swedes, who can't vote? And what are they saying?
Most Democrats living abroad seem to be Bernie supporters, although I would say that in my own circle, actually, a surprising amount are Hillary supporters. Swedes tend to be, you know, more to the left of Americans anyway, so I think that they're pretty enthusiastic about – they were pretty enthusiastic about Bernie. But for the most part, I think that they're just – glad to see a strong challenger to Donald Trump.
So let's talk about your Swedish friends and colleagues. And let's start with Donald Trump, since you just mentioned him. What do they make of Hillary's presumptive opponent?
Well, so I'm based in Stockholm most of the time, and the professors there at the Stockholm University seem almost to still think it's a joke. They can't quite get their head around the idea that Donald Trump really is the nominee. I get a lot of questions from people asking me all the time, you know, how is this really happening? Isn't something going to happen at the convention? I think they're in kind of a state of disbelief. I also think it reflects some fears about the state of politics in Sweden, because the right-wing populist party here has been gaining a lot of ground in recent polling. And, you know, I think Swedes see this as a reflection of what could happen in their own country.
Mm. So they see Trump as a possible mirror of what the future might bring to Sweden.
Yeah, and to all of Europe, with the rise of populist parties in a lot of Western countries.
I mean, Sweden is also progressive when it comes to women's issues. The fact that there's this historic milestone with Hillary Clinton as a presumptive Democratic nominee, first time in the United States, what do Swedes make of that? Is it kind of a ho-hum moment, or do they see kind of the consequential side of this?
I think that, you know, they're enthusiastic about having a female president. I question whether or not Swedes really get the full extent of the difference in women's equality or women's rights and feminism in the United States and in Sweden. I think that for them, it's not even a question that women should have equality and that things like extensive maternity leave should be guaranteed. So, you know, I think that they're excited that there is a female candidate in the United States and that she could be elected and poses a strong challenge to Donald Trump. But I think maybe they take for granted how extensive equality is in Sweden, and maybe don't consider the context in the U.S. as much.
Ian Higham, a Democrat abroad in Sweden, in fact. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Now that Hillary Clinton is the presumptive Democratic nominee, we also wanted to review what she's been saying when it comes to foreign policy. We asked Susan Glasser about this. She's the editor at Politico.
Increasingly, as she turns to the general election, Hillary Clinton really is going to define and already has started to define her general election candidacy as herself being the not Trump. And that is a role, as you saw last night when she claimed victory in the Democratic nomination fight. It's a role that she's actually increasingly comfortable with, arguably more comfortable making the case against Donald Trump. She effectively is saying the world can't afford Donald Trump. America can't afford Donald Trump. And she seems a bit more of a happy warrior, frankly, than she seemed in going after Bernie Sanders in a way that's made her more uncomfortable. Why? Hillary Clinton is a classic liberal interventionist. She is a believer in the international order that has more or less sustained the United States since the end of World War II. She is a very engaged participant in the world, notwithstanding her recent tax away from free trade positions to accommodate her Democratic primary electorate. And she fundamentally sees Trump as a challenge both on a policy level, but much more on even a stylistic level. She sees him as a dangerous rogue actor.
So when you say liberal interventionist, as in Hillary Clinton, is that code for she's more likely to take the United States to war than a Donald Trump? Or do you think she's going to continue kind of the Obama foreign policy, which she was a key part of?
Well, I think those aren't necessarily as much in opposition as you think. I mean, clearly, Hillary Clinton doesn't have a record that suggests she's going to go around starting new wars in some fashion. I think she's a product of the foreign policy establishment, which broadly speaking is liberal internationalist, willing to use military force when necessary. Remember Madeleine Albright, who was her husband's Secretary of State and was put in there and championed by Hillary Clinton in the 1990s. Albright, urging intervention in the Balkans, said, you know, basically, what do we have this fabulous military for if we're not going to use it? And at key points along the way in her career as Secretary of State, in her career as a politician, Hillary Clinton has shown certainly a willingness and more of a willingness than Barack Obama to use instruments of military force to achieve foreign policy ends. And I think that, you know, that's pretty consistent over a long period of time that she is more willing to do so and to consider that than Obama. Syria being probably the most clear-cut case inside his administration, right, where she really was pushing for more military aid to the Syrian rebels early on. She was pushing potentially to go in the direction of no-fly zone over Syria, which would have involved heightened military activity on the part of the United States. That's not the same thing as sending ground troops in or anything, which she did not advocate.
Right. Let me step back from the foreign policy for just a moment, Susan. This is the first time a major political party in the U.S. has effectively put forth a woman candidate. What does this moment mean for you?
Well, I think it is absolutely a milestone and is correctly being treated as such. You know, you can't think about the scope of all this and think on the one hand, it's amazing. 8 years ago, Clinton was reduced to talking about cracks in the glass ceiling. The fact that it's now reduced to a laugh line, that she lost her presidential campaign in 2008, is a remarkable testament to the fact that gender, you know, has not prevented her from becoming the first Democratic presidential nominee. It is an amazing story that she recounted that her own mother was actually born on the day that Congress was voting on the amendment to the Constitution that made women's suffrage legal. My own grandmother was born before women had the right to vote. And let's just say that her dying wish in 2008 was to vote for Hillary Clinton, not even so much for ideological reasons as certainly for the reasons that she thought it was incredible that in her lifetime, women would have gone from not voting to voting for a woman who had a good chance to be president. She did not live to see Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton, by the way.
Great story, though. Susan Glasser, the editor of Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
In a couple of weeks, British voters will decide if the UK stays or exits the European Union. It could get ugly, but no matter which side wins the so-called Brexit referendum, Britain will always be part of Europe when it comes to the beautiful game. Just look to Friday in France on the start of the European Soccer Championships. Three of the UK's so-called home nations have qualified for the championships: England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. That last one is a really big deal, and I asked my BBC colleague Chris Page to explain why.
Well, it's Northern Ireland's first major soccer tournament for 30 years. They've never qualified for the European Championships before. They have qualified for the World Cup three times before. In fact, they're the smallest nation ever to make the quarterfinals of the World Cup. They did that back in 1958. And then in 1982, they got out of the group phase. They knocked out the host on that occasion, Spain. And that was probably the high point in terms of Northern Ireland's footballing achievement. They qualified again for the World Cup in 1986. But since then, there have been a few very difficult years. The team wasn't performing particularly well. Also, problems off the pitch with sectarianism at soccer matches in Northern Ireland as the conflict in Northern Ireland was going on. However, with the course of the peace process, a lot of efforts have been made to change that. Now the team on a high again. They've qualified for the European Championships. They'll be kicking off on Sunday in France.
This has got to be huge news in Belfast. What are you hearing?
It's massive news in Belfast. There is a huge amount of interest in this. It's wall to wall on all BBC radio programmes here practically now, with people looking ahead to the Euros. You've got people putting out flags outside their houses. You've got people putting stickers up on their cars. It's the talk of the town in all the bars. People are really, really looking forward to the soccer kicking off. I should say, not everybody in Northern Ireland supports the Northern Ireland football team, because there is a political division here. You do get plenty of people in Belfast and in Northern Ireland who will support the Republic of Ireland's soccer team, and they are also playing in the European Championships this time around. It's the first time ever that Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland are playing in the same major soccer tournament.
Wow. In Northern Ireland, though, when it comes to the fans in the grandstand, I mean, there's peace today, but there's still tensions below the surface. Catholics, Protestants, that tension from years ago. I mean, how does that play out in the grandstands with the fans? How do they come together?
Well, there is a political division in Northern Ireland, and that does translate into some footballing fault lines. You have, I suppose, the population of Northern Ireland divided into two halves politically. You have unionists who will tend to support the idea that Northern Ireland should remain part of the United Kingdom. In their religion, they tend to be Protestants. Then you have Irish nationalists who believe that Northern Ireland should become part of the Republic of Ireland, that there should be a united Ireland, and they tend to be Catholics. So, as I say, you will have Protestants, unionists tending to support Northern Ireland. You will have Catholics, nationalists tending to support the Republic of Ireland. Now, over the years, I think that division has become less important. Yes, in this tournament, you will still have most Catholics saying that they will support the Republic of Ireland first, most Protestants saying they'll support Northern Ireland first. But you've heard more and more this time around that each side is wishing the other team well in the tournament. For example, you have the Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland, Martin McGuinness of Sinn Féin, an Irish nationalist, saying he's wishing Northern Ireland well. And in fact, he is likely to attend Northern Ireland matches in France, along with his main partner in the power-sharing government here, Arlene Foster. She's the First Minister and she's a unionist. So that will be another very important gesture of reconciliation here.
So, Chris, what are you going to be looking out for with Northern Ireland as these matches unfold?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's how well they're going to do. Northern Ireland certainly wouldn't be among the favourites in the tournament. In fact, you can get 150-1. They're the odds on Northern Ireland winning Euro 2016. But they are something of a form side, actually. They go into this tournament unbeaten in 12 games. That's the longest unbeaten run of any team in this tournament. So people here really talking that up. Their opponents in the group phase are Germany, Ukraine and Poland. Germany, of course, the world champions, but historically Northern Ireland have got a pretty good record against Germany, in fact. So people do look at that draw and think we've got a pretty good chance of getting out of the group phase. Were they to do that, that would be a huge achievement.
Chris Page, my colleague at the BBC, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
You're listening to The World. He volunteered for the Marines in 2006 at the age of 19 and went to Iraq with the infantry. He redeployed and returned to Iraq as a combat photographer and combat artist. Now, that's interesting enough, but we also wanted to speak with Maximilian Uriarte because he's got a graphic novel out based on his experience in Iraq. It's called The White Donkey. Maximilian Uriarte, in your new graphic novel, you write and draw about becoming a Marine, being deployed, the endless waiting, the tedium, and then these bursts of violence. Why did you volunteer in the first place?
I, much like Abe in The White Donkey, I was kind of just looking for something. I was looking for some, you know, worldly experience. It's always kind of weird to try to explain that I enlisted because I'm an artist. I think people think that I became an artist after the Marine Corps, during the Marine Corps, but really I was an artist my whole life. I had always taken my drawing and my art really seriously and writing. And at the age of 19, I decided that if I was going to do what I want to do, which is to create these kind of stories that I want to make, I really needed to gain some kind of, I don't know, worldly understanding or something.
But I mean, so Paul Gauguin went to the South Seas. You went to a completely different place. I mean, violent. what kind of inspiration do you think you were looking for in a war zone?
You know, I wanted to see something terrible. And that's sort of the driving force behind why I wanted to go to Iraq. And that was really what I wanted. It didn't really matter to me how I got there. And so my first thought was, what's the quickest way I can get to Iraq and see this war zone for myself to like really experience something like this? And so to me, that was the Marine Corps infantry. So I went into the recruiter's office and signed up and went infantry. My recruiter was like, are you sure you want to do that? Because you don't have to. You know, to me, it was like, what's the point of joining the Marine Corps if I'm not going to go infantry? Like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, you know, like really do it. So,
well, I mean, in The White Donkey, Abe is kind of periodically questioned by the other Marines, why would you do this? I mean, we know why we had to do it. I mean, help us understand why you, Max, why in your worldview you needed to see something terrible.
You know, I was working on, I had always wanted to write serious work. You know, I wanted to have a weight behind what I was saying because I felt like, you know, what do I have to offer the world right now? Like, I haven't really done much as a 19-year-old kid. So I wanted to go gain some kind of worldly experience in all of this.
Where does the title The White Donkey come from?
The White Donkey is a real thing that happened to me when I was in Iraq during my first deployment. I was on one of my first patrols ever in Zaidan, and we're traveling down Zaidan Road. I was in a mounted platoon, so I was in a convoy, and I was in the back seat of the second vehicle of the convoy. We had five vehicles, and I remember being absolutely terrified while I was there, because this is one of my first times outside the wire, and I had no idea what to expect. Because during training, they're very clear about, you know, look out for anything suspicious in the road. Anything could be an IED. Look out for trash and craters and dirt and anything that looks suspicious. And what they don't tell you is that when you get there, it's a third world country and everything looks suspicious because there's trash and craters and stuff all over the road.
Right.
So I was pretty convinced I was going to die. And I was like, you know, really regretting some life decisions at this point. And all of a sudden, our convoy just came to the sudden halt. It came to a stop. I remember it was like, oh, what's going on? You know, could have been, you know, an IED in the road or something. You know, there's a million reasons why you could stop in a convoy. And I hear my platoon commander in the front seat. He gets on the hook and he goes, hey, Vic 1, this is Vic 2. Why did we stop? And Vic 1, my section leader, Corporal Albrecht, he gets on the radio and he says, there's a donkey in the road. And I remember, like, you know, what does that mean?
was it code for something?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, what's going on? So I look in the front of the convoy, and there is this donkey. And it's not crossing the road. It's not just standing there. And it's walking dead center in the middle of the road in the same direction that we were going, as if it was leading the convoy.
It seems hugely emblematic of something. What is that white donkey?
Well, so for me, like that image, just like, mind you, it was like 130 degrees outside, so I could have been suffering from some kind of like heat stroke at this point, but it just burned into my mind. Like I couldn't get that image out of my head because this, you know, here we are, five vehicles, five armored, you know, weaponized vehicles with 23 Marines, every weapon you can imagine, rifles and grenades and grenade launchers and machine guns. And all the power and might of the United States military all brought to a screeching halt by this benign, stupid ass of an animal. I mean, that's what it is, literally an ass. And it was just this profound moment for me to see this. And that image just like never left my head. And so that really started to inform the kind of basis of the White Donkey story. And that ultimately led to the title of The White Donkey.
Your character, Abe, in The White Donkey deals with PTSD when he returns stateside. Did that happen to you?
No, I don't personally think that I really suffered from PTSD. I mean, my deployment was much like Abe's. It was really boring. The only thing that I sort of felt the residuals of were just being on high alert all the time. Like when I came home, again, I was in a mounted convoy, so we were driving around everywhere. And there's speed limits in Iraq when you're driving down MSR Mobile. Or these different roads, you can only go 35 miles per hour. That's like the maximum that the U.S. military rolls on the freeway. And so when I came home, I remember coming back to L.A. and me and my wife at the time, we're driving down the freeway, and it was just like mind-blowing how fast we were going, and it really made me feel uneasy, you know, going that fast. Like, oh my God, we got to slow down. We got to look out for things on the road, which is silly. You know, that's obviously not as much of an issue here in the States as it is in Iraq. But, you know, that's pretty much the extent of what I dealt with on a personal level. I would say in The White Donkey, Abe does not deal so much with PTSD. I mean, he does a little bit because of the traumatic event that happens to him near the end of the story or a little bit halfway. But Abe actually suffers a lot from depression. And depression and PTSD can go hand in hand, but they are kind of different. They're very different. And they get confused a lot in the conversation of war and trauma.
Would you say you've been dealing with depression since Iraq?
No. I mean, if I have, it's for reasons unrelated to Iraq.
And physical injuries? None?
No, I never got any physical injuries in Iraq.
I mean, I'm just curious, for an artist to volunteer and then return kind of safe and sound, what occurs to you when you see Marines and soldiers coming back dead or seriously injured for the rest of their lives?
I thank my lucky stars that it didn't happen to me. And, you know, I'm immensely respectful of those who, unfortunately, you know, I feel so lucky that I was able to go over there twice and come back in one piece, because I know a lot of Marines were not so lucky. But, you know, every Marine, every soldier, airman, sailor, and Coastie that I've ever met that has been met with these sort of life-altering injuries has always been, you know, the most resilient people I've ever seen in my life. These wounded warriors are really tremendous people, and they're, you know, they're the best.
Maximilian Uriarte is a Marine veteran and an artist. His new graphic novel is called The White Donkey. Great to meet you, Max. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You are with The World. I'm Marco Werman. More than 1 million Syrian refugees are living in Lebanon. Many of them are unemployed, but not Gaith. He's teaching people Arabic online.
I have around 30 students from USA, from England, from Pakistan. And most of them became my friends.
Learning Arabic from refugees. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is something exciting about being in a classroom and learning new things, but you don't have to be in a classroom to feel that same excitement. You could be online, and the student-teacher ratio could be 1-to-1, you know, individualized teaching and learning. That is the idea behind a program created by a startup that helps Syrian refugees in Lebanon. They're technically barred from holding jobs there, so many are struggling. But this online program also offers a welcome solution for some refugees. Christopher Livesay has a story from Beirut.
I've come to this cafe in Beirut to meet a young Syrian refugee named Gaith, or Gaith, or
Gaith. Ra. G-H is Ra in English. Ra in Arabic. There is no Ra in English, I know, but it's just in Arabic, those letters. And most of my students call me Gaith. Gaith. It's easier for them.
Gaith is an Arabic teacher. But until a few months ago, he was struggling to survive in Lebanon. There are more than 1 million Syrian refugees in this country of roughly 4 million people. That's more refugees per capita than any other country in the world, and they're not officially allowed to work. Suddenly, Gaith gets a call on Skype.
This is my student.
And this cafe is transformed into an Arabic classroom.
Alaykum salam.
He's part of a startup called Natakalam, which in Arabic means "we are speaking." The service puts Syrian refugees like him together with Arabic language students around the world. Holly is Skyping from New Mexico as she struggles through the lyrics of a Syrian pop song.
Listen to the sentence and tell us what that means, okay?
Oh boy, okay.
Okay, sentence by sentence.
Okay.
Natakalam was co-founded by a Lebanese-American named Aline Sarah. A year and a half ago, she was looking to improve her own Arabic, just as the refugee crisis was mounting in Lebanon. It dawned on her. A lot of these Syrians are highly trained and motivated, and they're just sitting around.
And I was thinking that, you know, while they're in this lingo, they could become conversation partners, right? So why not, you know, meet up with one of them and compensate them?
She saw a business opportunity in the U.S. where more and more people are learning Arabic. She shopped the idea around, put a website together, and when it was still in the trial phase,
the platform went viral without us being ready. This was right around August, and the website ended up being shared around 5,000 times in a week.
Nathakulam is a for-profit business, but the aim is to tackle social problems usually left to nonprofits.
It's something to be an aid organization and to give aid, to give food, to give money, but that's you're a passive recipient to aid. But what Nathakulam does is, I mean, we're giving them jobs and they're the ones who are helping the student. So it's flipped in that sense.
For students like Holly, Nathakulam's appeal is twofold.
Mush mazboot.
What's the meaning of mush mazboot?
First, they get private lessons for only $15 an hour, a bargain compared to in-person tutoring, which can run $50 and up. Second, Holly knows she's not only helping herself,
but also the teacher, because obviously, you know, the war in Syria has destroyed most of their lives, and it was nice to be able to, you know that I was also supporting and helping them in some small little way.
And Gaith can use the help. 3 years ago, when he escaped Syria, he entered Lebanon illegally, so he's living here in hiding. But with Nathakulam, he can earn $500 in a good month. And on a social level, he calls it his window to the world.
I have around 30 students today from USA, from England, from Germany, from Pakistan. Most of them became my friends.
All he needs is his laptop, a Skype connection, and someone like Holly on the other end.
Nagami is songs.
Nagami, yani melody.
For the world, melody. Christopher Livesay, Beirut.
Nagami. So, what's the meaning now?
When you're just starting to learn a language, the words can seem completely incomprehensible, right? But eventually communication starts to happen, almost like magic. Right now, though, we're going to learn about a made-up language with an incomprehensible script, or so I'm told. I'm in the studio with Nina Porzuki. She's one half of our podcast about language, The World in Words.
Hey, Marco. That's exactly right. This week on the podcast, we dig into the mystery of this book. I brought it in for you to check it out. Here, it's pretty heavy.
Yeah, I don't think you can do it with one hand. Oh, my God. It is heavy.
Very heavy.
Codex Serafinianus.
The Codex Serafinianus.
No. Serafinianus.
Serafinianus.
Throw in an extra syllable just for the hell of it.
Right. The Codex. We'll just call it the Codex.
So this is weighty. I almost need a team to carry it over to the mic. What is this?
I would describe it as kind of like an encyclopedia from an alien planet.
Yeah. That's a... Oh, my God. These weird-looking people with just legs and stars for... bodies.
Right. So imagine one of those old encyclopedias from the medieval times that explains everything from every kind of organism to, you know, language to the way people live, the whole thing.
And the script, Nina, the writing just looks like a bunch of doodles.
And it looks like it has some sort of meaning, right?
Could. Yeah.
Well,
I hope it does.
That's the question. We don't actually know what it means. The Codex was published in the 1980s, and it was written and illustrated by this Italian architect. His name is Luigi Serafini, hence Codex Serafinianus. And he's kind of a bit of an odd duck. He hardly has given any interviews about the Codex. And when he has done those couple of interviews, his explanation about the genesis of the Codex and where it came from and what he's trying to do and whether there's a cipher, well, it's nearly as cryptic as the Codex itself. Here's Serafini.
Allora, dunque, c'era una volta. Dunque, ma com'è nato? Beh, l'ho scritto tante volte.
The way it started was casual, he says in Italian at a rare 2014 press conference. It's a lot like the story of creation, as if the artist was possessed by something, by the zeitgeist, by the spirit of the times, by something shaped by forces we don't even know about, like aliens. I'm still quoting Serafini here. There's more. Today, actually, I took a taxi from the train station, and the cab driver said, for sure, aliens are among us, looking for diamonds. So every day, something happens that could be part of the Codex, like this cab driver who said aliens are here to look for diamonds. Okay, cab drivers, aliens, diamonds. What does this mean? And does a cipher exist to break Serafini's cryptic code? Kane Foucher is an unofficial Codex expert. Kane?
Yes. Hi, Nina.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, not bad.
He's been obsessed with the book ever since he first discovered it in a university library basement when he was an undergraduate at Carleton University in Canada more than a decade ago.
I'll confess I wanted to steal it. But I, of course, did not.
Eventually, he bought his own copy. But Kane's impulse, it's eerily familiar. There's just something about the Codex that makes you want to hold it and hoard it for yourself. It's really hard to explain. Almost as if you kept it close and you just kept thumbing through the pages, you'd suddenly find a clue to what this alternate world meant. So first you look at it, or at least in my experience, I looked at it, I see these images, and your eyes are completely drawn to these strange, weird images, like, you know, like a rainbow flying machine, or all the organisms that live in a stream of light, you know, the tiny organisms, or two humans that are having sex that turn into crocodiles. Crazy pictures. But then, for me, what pulled me in is this volume of text, because it's a serious book. I mean, it's super heavy, it's really fat, and it's full of, can you call them words? I don't know. Like,
yeah, that's the thing too, is that, you know, you really can't call them words. And there's a kind of logocentric bias we all have. We're trying to find some sort of, you know, what's the signifier here? Like, what is this? This must be saying something. You got diagrams here. It's quite elaborate. You've got tables. There's a language section where it seems to show all the sort of the glyphs, all the letters. And you're thinking to yourself, there must be some sort of meaning behind this.
Yeah, Marco Werman here, back in the studio with Nina Porzucchi. I want to echo what Kane Foucher says there. Is there some sort of meaning behind this book? Because it still seems like Mr. Serafini is pulling one over on us.
Right. Therein lies the mystery, Marco. So Foucher actually does go on to try and find the cipher to the Codex. And actually what he finds is pretty unexpected. But, dun, 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 to hear the full story, you're just going to have to listen to the podcast.
And you can get that podcast, The World in Words, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, anywhere you normally get podcasts.
And if you actually want to see the pictures from the Codex, you can head over to pri.org/language. We have a couple of pages of the Codex. You can see those weird images. Yeah.
Yeah, good luck trying to understand them. Nina Porzucchi, thank you very much, as always.
Always a pleasure, Marco.
The letter written by the woman to her rapist on the Stanford University campus is hard to read, but it's important to read it. Essential, really, to understanding the case. The defendant, former Stanford student and varsity swimmer Brock Allen Turner, was found guilty of sexual assault and sentenced to 6 months in a county jail. A lot of people have said the punishment was too lenient. We want to zero in now on a part of the case that's not getting as much attention, the part played by two Swedish graduate students. They witnessed the assault last year and physically intervened to hold Turner until police arrived. Carl Fredrik Arndt and Peter Johnson are their names. Swedish playwright Hedda Kraus-Sjögren used to live in the U.S. She's now in Stockholm, and she's been reflecting on the action these two young Swedes took when they stumbled on the crime.
Of course, it's great that they did it. But isn't that what we should expect from everyone who sees something like that, who sees somebody's physical integrity, you know, being breached? You want people to take action and immediately feel that this is not, you know, that something is wrong.
Also, having lived in the U.S. and Sweden, just compare, contrast for us how sexual violence is dealt with in the media in both countries.
There's been a debate in Sweden for some time. Obviously, we have a lot of problems in Sweden as well. I think the support for date rape victims is growing, and there's been a movement for some time in Sweden to support them. I think the important thing is, how do you treat the victim, and what is in focus when somebody's physical integrity has been violated in a sexual manner? Mm-hmm. When cases like this happen, it shows up some of the norms that maybe go a little bit under the radar, you know, the things that you take for granted in a society. And I would hope that really in any society, you couldn't take for granted that it's okay to violate somebody's physical integrity. And the fact that this perpetrator's father obviously, you know, has a hard time understanding the victim's point of view, it's surprising, I think.
Do you think you would encounter a reaction like that from a father in Sweden?
There's been a similar case not so long ago, actually, up north in Sweden, where a girl was more or less ostracized in her own small society after accusing a guy of raping her. And it became a huge outcry when this came up, when it became public. But in her community, she was really ostracized in a pretty awful way. So we've had a similar discussion not so long ago in Sweden.
Yeah, so Sweden is not immune to the trope of blaming the victim in rape cases.
No, not at all.
Hedda, as I said earlier, you're a playwright and you've dealt with gender-based violence in the plays you've written. Did this case make you think a little differently about your own work?
What we want to get at as writers are those subtle gray areas, situations where we can recognize ourselves and not put the bad things that we do outside of ourselves or outside of our own society or outside of our own family or proper context, so that we can zero in on it and see it and name it and understand it. We have a tendency to look to other contexts to look for problems in other contexts, and it's very difficult to face up to the issues that go on right beneath our own nose or eyes, whether it be in Sweden or in the US. So, you know, I think a lot of people can probably identify with both the perpetrator and the victim in this case. And of course, it's sad and tragic, but possibly something good could come out of that as well. Also, for I'm sure there will be things written about this and on this, maybe even a play, who knows.
We were talking about this a few minutes on the show, that there are more visible women in leadership roles in parts of the world, including Sweden. Does that help to put rape and sexual assault in a spotlight and prosecute the offenders?
That is definitely a part of it, because you tend to push issues that is close to you in one way or another. I think that can definitely be adding to the fact that issues like this come up higher on the political agenda.
It helps.
It helps, yeah.
Hedda Kraus-Sjögren is a playwright. She's been speaking with us from Stockholm. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. When you say ethnomusicologist, it's hard not to think of Alan Lomax. He's best known, of course, for his field recordings of folk musicians, songs he collected from the American Deep South to Uzbekistan. The British version of Alan Lomax was a man named Hugh Tracy. Starting in the 1920s, Tracy traveled to Africa multiple times and recorded the songs he heard there. Over the course of 50 years, Tracy collected some 35,000 recordings, like this one, of traditional African music. That archive has now been opened up by the International Library of African Music, and some London DJs have decided to give the tracks new life. The project is called Beating Heart. Chris Pedley is the musician and DJ behind it.
I first was introduced to Hugh Tracy through my wife. When we met, she had a photo on her wall of a Mbuti pygmy tribe in northern Congo, and they were all crowded around a speaker, staring in wonder and amazement at this speaker, and they were listening
like a loudspeaker.
Yeah, a loudspeaker. They were listening back to the music that they just recorded, beautiful singing, and yeah, that picture just intrigued me, and I've been on a whole journey over the last 5 years, and finally, with my friend Ollie, we've developed this project using the archive, mashing it up with contemporary artists to raise money for some people who are hungry in Africa, in Malawi.
Incredible.
Specifically.
I mean, that moment you describe of Hugh Tracy in the forest, I mean, these pygmies are hearing their own music for the first time, and Hugh Tracy is the one who made that possible.
That's right. He traveled all around sub-Saharan Africa, 18 countries in total. So he would travel from South Africa all the way up to northern Congo, over to Kenya, down to Mozambique. And yeah, it was an extensive work that he undertook.
Chris, as I said, you're sharing the music from the International Library of African Music with other musicians to remix. And one of them is Nabiha Iqbal. Her stage name is Throwing Shade. And Nabiha, you were good enough to come to the studio with Chris. You know, remixing is kind of reinterpreting, isn't it? Maybe even giving new meaning to a piece of music. Tell us about the track that you remixed, and what did you hear in the original version, and where were you considering taking it style-wise?
The track that I remixed was a traditional recording of mbira music, and the mbira is a thumb piano that's kind of quintessential of the sub-Saharan musical sound across Africa. It's made up of metallic keys kind of nailed onto a gourd, and you pluck them and create a melody. I just like the way that it sounds. So I took a sample of that, a loop, and I worked for quite a while with it, trying out different ideas. And then I decided to kind of stick with that motif of the mbira sound running through and build it up, but using my own sound palette that was like an electronic reflection of the raw field recording sound, and build it up that way.
It's a very dreamy sound, and funnily enough, it's called Dream Scene. Nabiha, what did it feel like taking music that feels and sounds like it comes from a completely different era, which it does, and then put it into this 2016 context?
It was an exciting project for me, firstly because I'm a big fan of Hugh Tracy's work anyway, having studied ethnomusicology at university. And one thing that I think anyone who's into music realises, that it's always just, you know, recycling different sounds. Everything that you put out as an artist creatively is you know, an amalgamation of everything that you take in. So getting the chance to work with these, you know, historical field recordings was a great opportunity to do this in a sort of more literal sense. Mm-hmm.
Chris, you know, one of the really interesting aspects of this whole project was that I gather a lot of people in Malawi didn't even really know this music or had heard it, and it's from their own country. You hosted earlier this year a special concert at Lake Malawi National Park where Malawian DJs involved in the project played these tracks for the first time. What was their reaction when they heard this stuff?
To be honest, it was the moment that I'd been waiting for, really. Getting there and hearing those tunes in the environment, seeing people connect with the music in a new way, because when we first played them the original tunes, they were puzzled as to where these tunes came from. They didn't even know that they existed. So we were playing those original tunes alongside the brand new remixes, and people were just getting down and dancing.
Chris, you're probably aware that there's been a lot of rediscovery of old African music recorded on vinyl and cassettes, and some of that has been reissued digitally on CD, other forms in the US and Europe. And there's been some concern that the original artists and their estates are not getting any of the revenue from these new sales. You have a different model. What are your thoughts on how best to remunerate these musicians?
The linchpin really was getting involved with social responsibility and interacting with local musicians, because often they're not actually documented, the people who actually recorded the songs. Mm. The bulk were recorded in 1950 and 1952, so most of the people are deceased and people don't know about it. So this is just the start of the dialogue. You know, it's better to put the music to work and get it out there rather than letting it just sit around in academic institution for
Precisely.
Study.
I was going to ask you, Nabiha, since you're a musician and also an ethnomusicologist. I mean, Hugh Tracy did preserve the music, but what does happen or what does not happen if those recordings simply stay in an archive on a shelf somewhere?
If those recordings do end up sitting on a shelf, I think we are not doing justice to the prolific work that Hugh Tracy carried out in his lifetime. I'm pretty sure he didn't make all of those recordings so that no one would ever hear them ever again. So I think that this initiative with the Beating Heart Project will probably open the doors for a whole host of other projects and things that people can get involved with, and also just making this music accessible to a wider audience.
That was London-based musician Nabiha Iqbal, a.k.a. Throwing Shade. We also heard from the creator of the Beating Heart Project, Chris Pedley. We have a few of the Beating Heart remixes over at PRI.org. You should check them out. They're really cool. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.